If you love BCFM, you can now get the brand new BCFM app. It is available on Android, iOS and BlackBerry. Visit your app store for more details. Just search BCFM.
BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. And on the day Bristol City Council finally published their first list of hopefuls, we have a studio full of mayor candidates. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers has the week off while we spend 2 hours coaxing promises from our current mayor, George Ferguson, all the political party candidates and two independents standing on platforms of poverty relief and education. In the run-up to Thursday, the 5th of May's local elections, I'll be hosting another two-hour-long politics show hustings a bit like this. In a fortnight's time, we'll be doing it all over again with the Police and Crime Commissioner candidates. They'll be sitting here on Friday the 22nd of April. On to the politics show mayor hustings in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and showers. This weekend, highs of 11, sunshine and showers. Windier, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, some sunny spells and fleeting showers. Next weekend, that's the 16th and 17th of April, highs of 14 Celsius, fairly sunny with occasional showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Now, accountants and auditors can be dangerous people. It was posh-sounding financial services firms like KPMG and PricewaterhouseCoopers that signed off the bank's accounts in 2007 and 2008 without apparently noticing they had hundreds of billions of pounds, black holes on their balance sheets that were, well, in fact, junk. Anyone who saw the film The Big Short over Christmas will know how risk managers and auditors can get things spectacularly wrong. But it's all okay because Andrew Tyrie MP and his banking commission recommended, didn't they, that our high street and retail banks should be separated forever from the casino banks, so the gamblers of the City of London could never again endanger our hard-earned savings. Only one problem, that never happened. Chancellor George Osborne fudged it by telling us all he might do it sometime in the future. More important than ever, then, that the annual budget of over £1 million here in Bristol, Bristol's mayor should be able to navigate his or her way around the accounts and the city's balance sheet. One thing the mayor really must be able to do for this special occasion. So we'll be looking at that just after 6 o'clock. We have a balance sheet for the last couple of years and also one equivalent from 1947, so we can compare what's being spent today of our money to what was just after the war in another age of austerity. So we have the incumbent mayor plus mayor candidates from Conservative and Labour parties, also Lib Dem, Green and UK Independence parties, and also two independents here. The list of nominees has only just been published today, so not all the 13 candidates are here. Also standing is Tom Baldwin, Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, and four more independents. That's Tony Britt, Stony Garnett, Mayor Kudihimbu and John Langley. By way of introduction, I'm going to ask all our candidates now to explain why we should vote for them. First of all, from Bristol First, it's the incumbent mayor, George Ferguson. George.
Hello, Tony. As everybody knows, I'm the incumbent mayor, and I stood in 2012 because I felt that Bristol was not getting on with the job it should be getting on with. It was too bogged down in politics, in bickering, instead of taking the tough decisions that needed to be taken. We hadn't invested enough in our infrastructure, our transport infrastructure, our housing infrastructure, and we needed to transform education across the city in an increasingly difficult climate where our education had been split up into academies, free schools and local authority schools, as well as the private schools. So I felt that I could bring my skills and experience of living and working in Bristol 50 years, being in charge of national and international organisations, to bear on the city. I've not regretted it for a minute. I feel that in 3.5 years we've made some real change in terms of the mood. As anybody knows, that from concept to completion, it probably takes that long to build a housing development, let alone turn a city around. And so we are now on the cusp of making those major changes. we're in a state of relative disruption while we build the new transport system. I accept that, but unless you've got the courage to get on with it, you will never cure the problem. And
okay, George, thank you.
Thank you.
Now over to Conservative candidate Charles Lucas.
Tony, good evening. I'm standing because I want to get Bristol, make a better Bristol for everyone. I want to get Bristol moving by attacking the problems we have with congestion and public transport. I want to give everybody a home. I want to build new homes. We need to build 85,000 new houses in Bristol over the next 20 years, and we are way behind our targets on that. And I just want to make Bristol a better place for everyone that lives here. We're such a fantastic, diverse community, and I just hope we can all take Bristol forward, and I hope that I can lead the city through that.
For Labour, it's Marvin Rees.
Yeah, hi, I'm Marvin. I'm running because I just think this is a fantastic city. But like so many people, I think that while we have a great story to tell to the outside world, and we've certainly done that very effectively over the last few years, there are tens of thousands of people in Bristol who are being left behind and who are not included in this wonderful city story that we tell. So it's really important, both for the sake of the integrity of the city and for the sake of any hope of building a prosperous and a strong political and economic future, that we actually prioritise tackling inequalities. We must look forward. We must build a strong economy, continue to support business, make sure that our public sector employers are fantastic. We have a thriving voluntary sector, but we cannot do that while leaving tens of thousands of people behind. Two-gear education process, locked out of skills opportunities and locked out of employment opportunities is totally unacceptable.
For the Liberal Democrats, it's Kay Barnard.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening. I'm standing because, although Bristol is one of the wealthiest cities in the country, I've got really frustrated and angry with the problems that we face when we live here. Transport is a nightmare. Housing is really expensive. The care of the elderly leaves a lot to be improved, and the inequality across the city is quite extreme. So the wealth is concentrated in certain areas, skills in certain areas, health. And I want to make Bristol, like everybody else, I want to make Bristol a better place to live. But I think I've got the skills and the experience to do that. And I have a very different perspective, being the only woman candidate from the major parties. I bring a different outlook on the problems that the city faces.
Now, standing for the Green Party is Tony Dyer.
Hello, everybody. The reason why I'm standing is I think this city needs to change, and it needs to change drastically. We are seen as a relatively successful city, but for far too many of us it feels sometimes as if there's a party going on and we haven't been invited. We have massive divisions and disparities between different parts of the cities in terms of health outcomes, educational attainment, quality of life. We need to invest in the housing that people can actually afford to live in. We need a transport system that works for everybody, it relies on it. We need education systems and skills that are fit for the 21st century, and we need to provide our energy by a means that does not destroy the only planet we have. We need to build a better Bristol. To be able to do that, we need to be able to work together. All of us need to be able to work together to get that better city.
With me from the UK Independence Party is Paul Turner.
Thank you, Tony. Good evening, everybody. As your new mayor, my priorities would be housing, building council housing, making sure that the nearly 200 people we have sleeping on our streets of the city tonight have a roof over their heads. I'd want to review the 20-mile-an-hour speed limit and resident parking zones with full consultation with residents and local businesses. To build and strengthen our economy so that we can actually create jobs for the future, so that our children and our children's children has a job to look forward to. But also accountability and spending prioritisation. I do feel local authority, as it stands now, has been very lax in their prioritisation and their lack of accountability. We need to have transparency. You, as a citizen of Bristol, need to be able to know where every single pound is spent and have the opportunity to question that if you wish to. It seems absolutely ridiculous to me that the top two dozen or so employees at the council can afford to give themselves large pay rises when we have people sleeping on the streets, and we have such good centres across the city like Hawkspring that are having to close down due to lack of funding. Education will be a top priority. We need to make sure that every child in the city has the opportunity of a quality education, but I'll let Christine develop on that a bit later.
Well, funnily enough, I was just coming to Christine Townsend, who is Independence for Bristol. Christine.
Hello, Tony. So I'm standing to raise awareness around the idea that Bristol can only reduce the levels of inequality that we currently have and have had for decades if the structures that separate our children at the age of 11 in their schools and increasingly at the age of 4 are broken down. Our secondary sector has been socially selective for years. Those of us that are Bristolian went to school in Bristol. We know that the posh schools was St Mary Redcliffe. We know that Bristol Cathedral School gathers the posh kids, and we know that the City Academy across the road here has concentrations of children that come from disadvantaged backgrounds. There's been a huge piece of massive pieces of research nationally and internationally about the impacts of poor children going to school with large numbers of other poor children, and the impact that has on their ability to achieve their own potential. Bristol, our children they're missing out on achieving their potential, and every day that structure is allowed to be maintained, and it doesn't matter that these schools are academies or they're faith schools, they serve our children, and they need to be serving a cross section of those young people that are growing up in Bristol right now.
Also an independent standing is Paul Saville.
Good evening, Tony. Hi, I'm Paul. Good afternoon. And when I first started out my campaign, it was mainly around housing and homelessness. I've been homeless twice myself, once when I was 16, once when I was 17. And I've seen what it's like actually on the street. But as I've got more involved in my campaign and speaking to Bristolians and trying actually just to even get access to hustings, what I've realised is that this democratic process is actually a farce, that only certain candidates are being invited to the hustings, selective news reporting in the BBC, etc., and it's just not inclusive. So that's kind of become another point I really want to try and raise as Mayor of Bristol. The truth and transparency thing runs very deep for me. We live in a grotesquely unequal country, but also a grotesquely unequal Bristol, as many people will know. Now, I want to try and do something about that. Now, Paul just mentioned that actually just a minute ago about the service directors at Bristol City Council, Nicola Yates, etc. Now, they've just seen a 20% increase in their pay, whilst our frontline services has cut. As many people will agree with me, it's just not acceptable. Massive pay rises for the top, whilst people sleep in tents on the streets of Bristol in the year 2016.
Okay, Paul, thanks. Now, you mentioned there the hustings. A month ago, three of those people here, George, Marvin and Charles, were invited by Business West, the Institute of Directors and Bristol Junior Chamber of Commerce to an invite-only hustings at Lee Court near Abbots Lee. These groups are the local force behind the TTIP trade deal. Yesterday, Lord Owen said the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership would mean the end of the National Health Service. And I'm going to ask particularly you three first, but everybody, what will you do about TTIP? And do you think Bristol should be doing and can do anything about TTIP, which allows big business to sue governments in the future over laws they don't like, and some say means the end of democracy? George, you first.
I think what we've got to do is make quite sure that we use our European representation, that's the Bristol Brussels office and our MEPs, to iron out all those issues that people feel TTIP will damage. And I'm absolutely with them. I think that TTIP is a threat to our local democracy. It's a threat to our environment. It's a threat to many aspects of our lives. But we've got to be practical about it. I don't think it's very useful just to declare a place TTIP free. It's like trying to declare it nuclear free or whatever. Of course, my emotion is on the side of that, but I want to be practical. I want to make change, and that is the way I approach
Charles,
things.
Charles, what do you think of the TTIP? And what can we do, more to the point, and if anything?
Well, I'm not sure what we can do, because obviously this is being dictated to Bristol by central government and other international governments. So the key will be to the devil, I suppose, is in the detail. And until we can see all the detail, we can't possibly comment. Having said that, I am more supportive than many of you of the principle of TTIP. I think there is potential to improve our trading with other countries around the world on the back of it, and I think that there is great potential to be had in it. But as I say, the devil's in the detail.
Marvin, it's a trade deal. Sounds a bit boring, but do you think it's important? Should we be doing something about it?
Well, it's the mayor of Bristol, and to be perfectly frank, it's not something that's necessarily coming up on the Bristol doorstep. What they're talking about is inequalities in the UK, lack of housing. But we do say that as political leaders, we obviously have to take account of the context within which we are hoping to lead Bristol. It makes me feel very uncomfortable, TTIP. I think the burden of responsibility of those advocating for it is to prove that we will be able to protect our vital public services from the encroachment of the power of some of our world's biggest and most dangerous corporations. So, absolutely, I mean, like I said, it makes me feel incredibly uncomfortable. But I do think we need to see what details come out of it. And unfortunately, at the moment, a lot of those details are being hidden, which compounds this kind of sense of mystery and discomfort with
okay,
it.
Tony Dyer for the Greens.
I think TTIP deal is a very dangerous thing it's going through. I think it has the potential to damage British jobs. It's worth pointing out that the investor dispute system that's going to be part of TTIP will only be available to foreign countries. British companies won't be able to use it within the UK. Only foreign companies would be able to get access to that system. That means that there's a danger it could affect British companies and mean a loss of British jobs. Also, it will allow private companies to sue the government to ensure that public services are made available to private companies when we want to keep so many of them in-house. I'm very, very concerned about TTIP. I think not having enough information is the reason why we should be opposing this on the precautionary principle and saying until we get more information, then we're not prepared to sign up to it.
Okay, Kate Barnard.
Yeah, well, TTIP is being negotiated for at least the past 3 years, I think, and it's probably got at least another year to go, so we don't know the final shape of it yet. As far as healthcare, well, under the previous Labour and now Conservative governments, they can sell off the NHS as much as they like, I think. So I don't think that TTIP will make a lot of difference to that. I mean, a lot of our services have already been privatised. It will have to be ratified by each independent national government. So there is something we can do if we don't like it at the end. We can pressure our own government to reject it, and it will get rejected.
OK, Paul Turner for UKIP.
TTIP is an extremely dangerous trade deal that's going ahead at the moment. There's no doubt that we need a trade deal with the United States of America, but this is not the way to be dealing with it. We need to be acting on our own as an independent nation. It'd be a lot easier, a lot quicker to establish a trade deal. The problem with TTIP is that every single public sector job in this country could be at threat from it, and the only way we can stop it from happening, because it will happen if it's left to the European Union, the only way is to make sure that we leave the European Union.
Paul Saville.
It's hard going at the end, isn't it? Because everyone's already kind of covered stuff. But for me, this is about giving more power to the super rich of the world and taking it away from everyday people like ourselves. So, yeah, I'm absolutely in opposition of this TTIP deal. It sounds very boring as well, doesn't it? TTIP. No one really knows what it's all about. And I think, as Tony said earlier, you know, until we know more about it, then, of course, it shouldn't go through. This is about truth and transparency, essentially. So, we need to kick that into touch, really, innit?
Okay, Christine Townsend.
I've got to say, I'm actually horrified that Charles Lucas describes it as being dictated by central government, because we're actually the people that put central government where they are. I'm no expert about TTIP, I'm no expert with trade, but the idea that massive American corporations can come and sue governments in Europe, and the idea that corporations are going to come in and start kind of supplying our NHS or taking over parts of our NHS fills me with horror. And the idea that central government is going to dictate it for us, I just find that quite insulting, actually.
Okay, let's move on to another tack and start with you this time, Marvin. Do you think spiritual beliefs are important in politics? And if you have any, would you like to share them with us?
Yeah, I think spiritual beliefs are important in politics. I think non-spiritual beliefs are important in politics. Beliefs are important in politics. If you're asking if I'm a Christian, then yes, I'm a Christian.
What about you, Charles Lucas? Are spiritual beliefs important in politics? And would you like to share them with us if you have any?
I think everybody's entitled to their own beliefs, whatever they may be. And I have... I don't care whether people are... what religion they are, what their beliefs are, whether they have a belief or not. And I don't believe it's particularly relevant. I think everybody is entitled to their own opinions on that sort of thing.
George Ferguson.
I believe it's ethical beliefs and competence that are important in politics. We want people who understand how to make things happen, and that seems to me much more... You can have all the ideas in the world, but unless you can make them happen. Actually, I find it terribly distasteful the way American politics is dominated by religion, and I certainly don't want to see this country going that way.
Christine Townsend, do you think spiritual beliefs are important in politics?
No, I don't. And the reason for that is that there's some controversy at the moment going on in Northern Ireland around the difference around the Abortion Act and the abortion bills and the legislation that enables women in this country to seek abortion with two doctors, and that doesn't happen to Northern Ireland, and women have been coming over from there to seek abortions, and that's down to spiritual beliefs, and they impact at a gender level in a different way, let's put it that way, because the institutions that have been set up around spiritual beliefs are those of patriarchy.
Paul Saville.
Okay, so there's a big difference between religious beliefs and spiritual beliefs. I would consider myself a spiritual person, but that's my business. It's a personal thing. And Charles just said it, it's up to the person. I don't mind if you believe what you want to believe, as long as it's not dangerous and... whatever else, and what's the problem? I mean, it's what you're doing in the job for people, representing people, because actually it's when you're the mayor, it's not about you, it's about what people want you to do.
Okay, Paul Turner from UKIP, do you think spiritual beliefs important in politics?
I think it's important for politicians to understand spiritual and religious beliefs, but I don't think it's actually important in politics. One of the things I love about this country is that by law, people have the right to practice whatever religion they wish to, as long as it's within the confines of the law. And I think that's something that's fantastic about this country. But no, it's not important that it is part of politics.
How about you, for the Lib Dems, Kay Barnard?
No, I don't think spiritual beliefs are important. What is important in politics is morals and ethics, that you have to act honestly and fairly and treat people with respect. That's the most important thing in politics.
Finally, Tony Dyer.
I think what's very important is what people believe in, and that's informed by many different ways. I'm an atheist. How my values are formed may be different from how other people's values are formed, but there are different ways that can be created, and I think if those values are good values, then wherever they come from, it doesn't matter.
Well, Marvin Rees has just waved his little interrupt card, so go on, Marvin.
Well, it wasn't an interrupt card, it was a I have something to contribute card. I just think we do contend, a number of the contributors have suggested, there is always a danger in the relationship between faith and politics. There's a danger in the relationship between non-faith and politics. There's a fantastic observation, I think it was a great observation anyway, made by Barack Obama before he was well known. And he talked about, who would Martin Luther King be without his faith? Who would Fannie Lou Hamer be without their faith? Who would Malcolm X be without their faith? And the point he was making was, as George referred to, the danger in US politics. If you ask people, if people don't have a faith, they shouldn't come pretending to have one. If they do have one, they shouldn't be asked to leave it at the door. The importance is the values you bring to the role, and the morals you bring to the role. But whatever the source of that is, as long as you're not imposing it on anyone, you know, as long as we're not trying to run, we're trying to run to become political leaders, not religious leaders of a city, then that's actually what's important.
Okay,
and
Marvin.
I think at the core of that is about the drive towards a more just and caring society.
And now Christine wants to.
I find it interesting that Marvin uses examples from males. Simone de Beauvoir was not in any way spiritual, and neither was Rosa Luxemburg. They came from a completely non-spiritual, non-religious sort of perspective.
Good point. Anyway, thanks. We'll move on now, Jenny, to talk about your personal... another one. George, go for it.
I mean, yeah, of course, Marvin took some good examples, but my concern is... the entitlement that it sometimes gives to people like George Bush and Tony Blair and fighting wars for a Christian reason.
Were they Christians?
And, well, I think they used their belief to prop up their reason for fighting a war.
Jeremy Paxman,
and I think that's extremely
dangerous. Jeremy Paxman asked them if they prayed together and they wouldn't answer, would they?
Oh.
Anyway, thanks for that. We're going to go on to talk about the Panama Papers briefly now. I'm going to go around the table and ask you if you can sum up in 30 seconds what you make of these leaks about tax avoidance. And also, if you, maybe starting with you, Christine, what's your personal wealth and how much wealth do you have in tax havens or other tax avoidance schemes?
I couldn't even name where tax havens are other than the ones that are in the papers. What my personal wealth? I don't have a mortgage, that's about it. There you go.
Okay, Paul?
Have I got a tax haven?
Yeah. What's your personal wealth, and how much do you have in tax havens?
Okay, so I don't have a tax
haven. Or tax avoidance scheme.
Okay, so I don't have a tax haven. My electric bill's due, and it's £170 at the moment, overdue by about 2 months. So that's what I'm trying to chase at the moment, is that £170. It's an everyday struggle, as many people in the city are also facing. So no, I don't have a tax haven.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, what about you, Paul Turner, for UKIP?
I live in a council flat. I live off £100 a week. I don't have a great deal of money, and I certainly don't have anything stored away in tax havens anywhere.
Okay, what about you, Kay Barnard?
Well, I've got savings that I built up during my working life at over many, many, many years.
Would you like to share with us how much?
No.
Okay.
Why should I?
No, it's fine.
Certainly not in tax havens.
Okay, and you, Tony Dyer?
Well, I live with my in-laws. In regards to how much money I have, I'm not absolutely certain. I don't think it's very much, but my wife would be able to tell you better.
Give us a guesstimate, if you're happy to share it.
I have no idea, actually. I think it's probably a couple of £100 in the bank account. That's probably about it at the moment.
Okay, Marvin, what about you? What's your personal wealth?
I just want to carve out 10 seconds. What's your personal wealth?
Sorry, mine?
Yeah.
It was probably about £3,000.
Okay,
something like that. But anyway,
I like the example that you shared. So actually, my personal wealth has dropped considerably since becoming a candidate, which is one of those things people don't often realise, is that it's a financial blockage to political participation, which frustrates me with the anti-party stuff sometimes. But no, it's okay. I mean, I have a wife and 3 kids, and we get by. But we've taken a big hit from the campaign.
So you don't want to share with us how much?
No, I don't. I don't think my wife would like me to.
Charles
either.
Lucas, what about you? And you know, you do feel free to comment on what you think about this whole Panama Papers business this week. Charles?
Well, to answer the first question about my personal wealth, I have money invested in businesses. I have very little personal money because it's all invested in my businesses. And I have a wife and 3 children. And life is very expensive. So But I would say that all my money is safely in the United Kingdom. There is no money offshore.
So you don't want to share with us your personal wealth?
No, I don't.
Okay,
thank you.
George, what about you? What do you make of the Panama Papers? And would you like to share with us yours?
I think it's extremely sleazy. I have made and lost money. I've learnt by it over 50 years of working and living in Bristol. I only think money has one single purpose, and that is to do good with it. And so my aim is to make quite sure that I can do the maximum good. And I will share with Marvin, being mayor is not very good for making money either, and it certainly shouldn't be.
I don't know if that's not the public narrative.
George, would you like to share with us what your personal wealth is?
No. I think, it goes up and down so much, I wouldn't be able to tell you.
Really? Okay, Tony, you wanted to interrupt there.
Yeah, I just wanted to interrupt very quickly, because the Panama Papers thing is, I think, a very massively important scandal that's happened in our country, and we're in danger of trivialising it a little bit here by talking about individuals' bank accounts. What we have is massive amount of money, which is... Well, taxes have been avoided, and these are the taxes that can pay for the housing all of us want to deliver, for the transport system that all of us want to deliver, the education services that all of us want to deliver. That's much more important than the fact that one of few of us might have a bit more money than one or two of the others of
Thanks.
Us.
Thanks. And also, Paul Turner from UKIP wants to say something.
Yeah, I very much agree with much of what Tony said there. I do believe that if people are using these tax havens to avoid paying taxes that are due in this country, then they should be prosecuted. There's no two ways about it. They're wealth should be seized, and it should be considered a criminal offence.
Okay, Bristol's mayor has a unique opportunity to publicly challenge Parliament. Sorry, you can only do it once, Marvin. interrupting. Bristol's mayor has a unique opportunity to publicly challenge Parliament over things like austerity and immigration. Will you speak out for the people that vote for you? And if so, what will you challenge London on? Let's start here with Kay Barnard.
Well, the first thing is to get better investment in our transport services. I use the buses. I use the Severn Beach rail line, and it's shocking, the state of transport in this public transport in the city. So that's the very first thing I'd want to do. I think try and sort that out as best I can. Get some investment in this city.
Okay, for UKIP, Paul Turner, what would you challenge London on?
Well, firstly, I think any challenges must be for the benefit of the. Of all the people of Bristol, not just those that might vote for me or anybody else. Secondly, we have to look at the amount of control that the central government has over funding to the city. One thing I would like to see very much is a lot more of the taxes are actually raised in the city to stay in the city for the benefit of the city and all the people that live here. We can start talking about challenging them on things like transportation, on housing, and many, many other things. But I think the first thing we have to do is turn around to them and say, no, you're not going to take all of this money away from Bristol. We want to keep it here to serve Bristol and the people that live here.
Paul, will you speak out for people that vote for you against London? And what, if so, what on what subjects?
Well, the biggest one really is this referendum that I think Bristol deserves over the mayor thing itself. You know, I think people were at the time back in 2012, low turnout of votes. People really didn't know what they were voting for. And now, you know, with the incumbent mayor and stuff, I think people have realised that actually he's done quite a lot of damage to Bristol. So I think if Bristol was to be given another referendum, then it might come out different. And I think that's the first thing that I'll be pushing for as the new mayor for Bristol. Get rid of the mayor.
Okay.
Potentially.
What about you, Christine?
I think that the biggest thing actually that's impacting on Bristol and the country is the austerity ideological agenda, and that's hitting all public services. It's also about privatisation, I think, of the NHS, which is what we're seeing with the junior doctors, and also the forced academisation. I think that austerity agenda has tentacles that reach all the way down, and that is what I want to see the next mayor going and talking to Westminster about. And rallying people in the city behind them.
Well, in a way, this is a special question for you, George, because you've already had the chance to be doing this for the last 3.5 years. What are the main things to challenge London on? And are you proud of your record so far?
I am. It's centralisation. We have the most centralised government in Europe and one of the most centralised governments in the world. And I think that the devolution deal that we're currently doing is an important start. But we've got to have a financial devolution to come with it. I think we have an appalling tax system. It's unfair. It's virtually a poll tax. And what we need is a local income tax so that we can have a much fairer system in terms of distribution. That would begin to eat into the unfairness that we have in this city. And so to me, it's to add financial devolution to the devolution of powers that we're getting through the current deal.
Now, Paul Saville, you want to interrupt there?
It's more of a contribution. Again, like Marvin said, it's not an interruption. But one of my ideas, one of my policies is actually to bring in a special Bristol tax, which will seek to take money from the corporations which trade in our city. For example, Vodafone, who are notoriously well known for not paying their taxes, generally speaking. But and then reinvest that money into local independent startup businesses in Bristol. For example, like I started off, I really struggled when I started my small business. I sell tea and I really struggled even to buy pots and pans for my business. So the money that we get from the Bristol tax could be put into local independent Bristolian businesses.
Okay, Charles Lucas.
Well, to answer the first question again, Tony, I am would like to make it very clear that I am very free and independent of the Conservative Party in central government.
What would you take them on over?
take them over on anything that was right for Bristol. I have no qualms about questioning absolutely anything that was dictated by Central London if it was in Bristol's interest.
Is there anything you'd like to just share with us now you think is really out of order that you would take them on over?
Well, I mean, there have been numerous recent issues. There are a lot of, high profile in the media activities. The adjustments to personal impact payments and things that were made in the budget were wrong. And I certainly would take them on, you know, challenge them on that.
Marvin.
I think, just as was mentioned earlier, the narrative of scarcity that we are being sold and how that translates into austerity. I think it's an envelope that they're sticking us within that is a false envelope. It's false financial choices. I think that feeds into also a narrative of division. When a prime minister talks about bunches of migrants, while at the same time many of the people in this country feel totally underserved by the country, that sows in divisions that take place on the streets of Bristol and don't help us build a coherent society. Clearly, we need more power. But there's something very important about that I feel very uncomfortable with the idea of central government devolving power to local elites. You know, it's not just about geographical location decision making. We have to take account of the fact that the country, the world, is being dominated by a certain class of people. In the UK, it's the 7% of people who went to independent fee-paying schools. That question of social mobility and inherited privilege and inherited power is something that we have to take on if we want genuine political change, not just taking your political labels off after 30 years.
Tony.
Cuts, cuts, cuts. That's what needs to be challenged. It's the woe myth, the woe rotten story about the idea that the economic crash was caused by the very poor, when instead it was caused by some of the very richest people in this country who are continuing to be rich and whose names are almost certainly going to be cropping up in that Panama Papers. There is money out there. The money is available. There's £90 billion a year avoided in tax avoidance schemes in which people make a lot of money out of. There's billions of pounds that could be raised by a financial transaction tax on the operations of some of the financial services that caused the problems in the first place. That's what needs to be challenged, is that road story. And if we are going to have devolution, and I think we do need devolution, it needs to be real devolution that allows us to collect the wealth that we create in this city and use it and share it with our own citizens.
Well, Tony, a couple of people have mentioned austerity. Let's just have a quick question on austerity with a quick answer from each of you. And actually, let's start with Charles Lucas this time. Charles, austerity is the economic policy which is supposed to deliver success since the 2008 roughly £500 billion bailout of the banks. Is it the right policy and has it worked?
It is working. It is working more slowly than everybody would like. But the scale of the mess that the coalition government inherited in 2010 and the massive hole in our national budgets was such that it was the method, the policy, if you like, that was chosen to resolve it. And it is working. It's just due to the world economy as a whole. It is working more slowly than we would all like it to.
George.
I think there's a lot of wishful thinking that somehow by taking a completely different tact, all would be wonderful. The fact is that alternative Conservative and Labour governments have both taken roughly the same tack in terms of austerity measures. And while I want more of government, ask for more, we simply have to live within our means, and I think it's about testing what are our means. But I will do everything I can to get the best deal for Bristol within the financial circumstances, but I do deplore some of the financial illiteracy that we hear from certain parties within the Commons currently.
Christine.
Well, for me, it appears that when it was the banks, the money can be found by central government.
Yes, £500 billion.
Yeah, when it's bombing Syria that costs £500,000 each time there's a plane goes out, we can find the money for that. When it's about building nuclear power stations down in Somerset, the money can be found. But when it's actually about ordinary people with the welfare state and cutting disability benefits, then we haven't got the money.
Paul?
Yeah, similar again. I think what we really need to look at is puncturing the myth of austerity. Charles is right to a certain degree. It is working, but it is working for the rich. And many people are waking up to that fact every single day in Bristol. And that's the reality, is that some people have lots in the society. Some people have absolutely nothing. And it's absolutely shocking in 2016.
Well, certainly the current austerity measures, I don't think, are working for anybody apart from, as Paul just said, the wealthy in the country. Certainly myself, and I think many people around this city would say that they've not seen any benefit whatsoever. But then again, neither is spend, spend, spend the answer. So I think we do have to have a better measured approach. We do need to understand that we can live within our means. However, what I don't think is that we're not really truly seeing what our means are. There are lots of businesses, as we've heard with the Panama Papers, that are sneaking absolutely vast sums of money out of the country without paying tax on it. So I do think the means are there, and I don't think we need to go down the route of the austerity measures that we're currently being applied to us. There is a better way.
Kay Barnard for the Lib Dems.
Well, the recovery seems to have stalled, doesn't it? And further cuts, I think, are being driven by a right-wing ideology that private is somehow good and public services are somehow bad. I think that's something the Conservatives have signed up to, and that's absolutely not something I would agree with. We need good public services, so I don't think the austerity cuts that are proposed now are a good idea at all.
Tony Dyer.
Well, just make it clear, austerity is economically illiterate. That's why we have had the slowest recovery to a major recession since records began. I'm really getting tired of politicians blaming the previous politician 4 or 5 years ago. If we did that in the private sector, you went in and you were said to your boss, the reason why you haven't hit your target is because of the guy you had the job 4 or 5 years ago. I think you won't last very long in that job, so much for the private sector. Let's be absolutely blunt about this. Christine mentioned it before. We seem to be able to find money to bear at the banks. I think the actual amount that ended up being added onto our debt as a result of that was closer to £2 trillion rather than just the £500 billions. And we can find money for that, but if you're a steelworking organisation, we can't find the money.
I don't want to be too much of a stickler for figures, but I think the national debt is only £1.5 trillion at the moment.
It was £2.2 trillion.
Anyway, Marvin, what's your views on this?
Well, we were, I mean, in terms of advocating for Bristol, we were promised at the beginning of the last campaign that the doors of London were already open to Bristol going and demanding
more. But is austerity the right policy?
No. I just think it doesn't make financial sense. A number of things. One is, I just want to pick up on that again. It's always referring back to the last government, and as though it was their policies that caused the financial crisis. I thought that casino banking had something to do with it as well, and we seem to be missing that one off the table altogether.
But it was the last government that bailed out the banks, wasn't
also,
it?
Also, I would say that there's something about the cost of the cuts that's never taken into account, and we looked at this in public health. When we begin to cut vital public services that hit the front line, in fact, public health's a classic, we cut spending on mental health, for example, this isn't an abstract. This turns up as a cost elsewhere in the system. So we end up paying somewhere down the line for the interventions that need to kick in when people are hurt, when communities are
undermined. Can I try and pin you down on this, Marvin? Because it was the last Labour government that bailed out the banks and have caused the massive national debt, which is causing, supposedly, anyway, austerity.
But bailing out the banks wasn't about causing the financial crisis. That is as a consequence of the financial crisis and a distorted economic order in which some corporations were just too big to fail.
Did we do the right thing by bailing out the banks?
Well, I think we did. I think we had to. Because it was a fault, it was an unavoidable choice.
So we're going to be saddled with this massive debt forever now?
I think so. Well, I'm not saying we're going to be saddled with it forever. That's your choice. But I don't think we should be cutting at the rate we're cutting on the backs of the poorest people. But financial institutions were too big to fail. That was the model we had. And I was concerned about the catastrophe we'd fall into if we just let them go to the wall.
Let's move on. The Bristol Society of Merchant Venturers, George's favourite topic, were behind the Cabot reconnaissance and subsequent genocide of 12 million Native Americans, although Cabot obviously wasn't personally responsible for all of that, as well as the transatlantic slave trade, where 1.5 million were killed in the crossing alone. But now they say they give back much more to the city than they take, given that their royal charter means they don't have to submit accounts. Christine Townsend, should we believe them?
We don't know whether to believe them, do we? Because we can't see what they're investing their money in. This organisation are sponsors of our state schools. They've got the Merchants Academy in the south. They've got the Colston Girls Trust, which has got numerous primary schools. But they're also involved, as we know, on an individual basis, and, you know, with some kind of arm's length organisations in numerous other secondary schools and primaries in the city. And I want to know where the Merchant Venturers as an organisation do they have shares in. If they've got money in insecurities, I've got an issue with them sponsoring our schools.
George Ferguson, you're a former member of the Merchant Venturers, so maybe you're best placed to answer this. We hear the Merchant Venturers give back to the city more than they take. Can we believe them when they won't have open accounts?
Well, I know that is true. I know from my past involvement with the Merchant Venturers that they give virtually everything to the city in various ways. It's not a take organisation. It is absolutely a giving organisation. It's a charitable organisation. So I understand the history is difficult and challenging, and the slave history is completely unacceptable in every way. But in a way, I think the modern Merchant Venturers are making reparations and invest money into good causes in Bristol.
Okay, Charles Lucas, what do you make of the Merchant Venturers?
They are a tremendous force for good within Bristol. They have turned around, if we're focusing on education, they have turned around one of the most poorly performing schools in Bristol and turned it into a success story.
What was that then?
The Merchants Academy, was Withywood Academy. Sorry, whatever it was called, Withywood School, sorry. The merchants also, as part of their good works within Bristol, as you've heard, are charitably focused. They do tremendous work caring for the elderly, and they are involved with giving a great deal of money and time to the city, right across the city, in many diverse ways.
Marvin?
Makes me feel incredibly uncomfortable to have a club. It's not simply about how much money you give away. It's a question of power. And it's a question of inequalities in power. My view is we cannot be true equals until we are talking as equals, and that means equal political power. And no matter what good is done, if you have a group of people who collect together on a class basis, on an education basis, whatever, you know, and they connect and they create opportunity for themselves, and that's a really uncomfortable aspect of Bristol life. I mean, politics, the kind of politics I want, the kind of Bristol I want, is not one where a few people eat the crumbs that fall from the table, even if those crumbs turn into chicken legs. It has to be about we're all sitting at the table shaping the city's future together. And I think it's also a little bit, it makes me feel uncomfortable that while we have electoral politics, there are big decisions being made by people who are unelected in Bristol, huge amounts of influence over the city where people are unelected. We have to look at that. We have to actually address that and take it on and put it
okay.
In the open.
Tony Dyer, the Merchant Venturers. Should we believe them if when they say they give back more to the city than they take when they don't have open accounts? It's a royal charter.
Yeah, the Royal Charter, but I think the general problem here is secretive accounting in all its styles. It doesn't matter which organisation it is. If you're secretive about your accounts, then you need to expect to be challenged about that, and you need to expect that people will have concerns and may not believe you. And the only way to get rid of that unbelief is to publish your accounts.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I'm very suspicious, actually. We don't know, do we, about the money involved. But the wealth of many of the business people in Bristol was built on not just on slave trading, but exploiting former colonies. And it seems to me that it from the outside, the Freemasons looks a bit like the Masons. The Merchant Venture looks like the Freemasons. So, sorry.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I can just contribute quickly here, because they have a junior warden, don't they, George, and a senior warden, who then becomes the master. And that's exactly the same pattern as in the Freemasons,
it?
Yeah.
Oh, and the other thing is there's almost no women on the trustees or board members or whatever they're called, which again makes me a little bit suspicious.
George, do you want to, as an ex-Merchant Venturer, answer that about the women point?
Well, I made a very strong point that there should be women, and women were introduced to the Merchant Ventures, and they made it a damn sight better, as women always do when they come into any organisation. But I think there's too much emphasis placed on power. I don't see the Merchant Ventures having any power at all. They have no power over me or the city.
Paul?
Well, to actually answer your question, Tony, the answer is no. Without looking at their accounts, you cannot say that they are doing what they're doing financially. And I think it's the same with any organisation like that. Without looking at the accounts, it leaves them open to make whatever statements they wish about how much they're spending here, there and everywhere. But unless you can look at the accounts, you cannot say whether that is truthful or not.
Paul Saville?
Yeah, so I learned a lot of stuff over the last few years about the Merchant Ventures. The most recent thing is, and actually if the Merchant Ventures are interested in giving back to Bristol, why don't they give the port back that they've taken off us? George decided to sell it off to two Merchant Venture friends for £10 million, which was very, very cheap, actually. I think it worked out to be 95 pence per square metre. Don't quote me on that, but it's very low anyway.
It was about, I think, £3,000 or £4,000 an acre, wasn't
but,
it?
But just to focus on George, I do believe that Charles is also a Merchant Venturer, if the internet proves me right. I think Charles is also a Merchant Venturer. So it's actually... Charles,
hang on, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm a current, current member.
And will you carry on if you're mayor as a Merchant Venture?
Absolutely.
Okay, not like George then, you won't
nope,
say...
I won't.
You don't think there's a conflict of interest there?
No, I don't.
Can I just finish off, though? But yeah, and the other example, which was, you know, a lot of people really campaigned over it, was the Cathedral School, which was a great, great loss to Bristol. We lost the basement of the Cathedral School, and that was also sold off to a Merchant Venturer. So it's not even hidden in Bristol anymore. It's very, very open about these sell-offs. It's terrible, and it's a disgrace to Bristol, actually.
George, did you want to say something?
I think I better answer the question about the port. I didn't sell the port. The port was sold by the Labour administration in 1996 on a 150-year lease. And all I did was sold the remaining freehold, which had very little value. I was advised that it had a value of hundreds of thousands of pounds. The only buyer that it has value to is the port itself, that marries that long lease with this residual freehold. The valuations that were done before I came in were about £3 million to the port as the freeholder. I got a further valuation which doubled that to about £6 million once they knew that we'd done a £10 million deal. Well, because that's what valuers do when they'll so. The £10 million was an extraordinarily brilliant price. We did a really good deal, and we still
George,
retain.
George, just a second.
We still retain an investment in the port, 12.5%.
Hang on a second.
And that investment is worth more than the whole port was.
Okay, just
when
a second,
we sold it.
George, because the city sold that 2,600-acre port last year to date.
No, you're wrong. The city,
the actual
sold
freehold
the long
of it.
Lease.
The
on
freehold
that.
Was sold
yeah,
last year,
yeah,
wasn't it?
The freehold is the residual freehold, which has on a peppercorn rent has virtually no value.
So I can just put, and then you can reply once I've just said this. Yeah. So it was sold to David Ord and Terence Mordaunt for £10 million.
It was sold to the company.
Now that's about £4,000. An acre, the 12-acre Wallon site was sold for £6 million. That works out about £500,000 an acre.
That wasn't on a land lease.
Just let me finish. The land value, the 2,600-acre port, was worth a £1.3 billion. If you were to use that as an equivalent,
that is a wonderful
which is a
example.
Lot more than the £10 million
no, Tony,
that we got for it.
Tony, excuse me. That is a wonderful example of financial illiteracy. And if you were running the city, I'd be terrified.
So would you just like to explain why it's...
Because I've explained it. If you sell land on a long lease or freehold...
Okay, how
you
long,
sell
was,
it
on
how
a long
lease,
was the long lease?
Till 21,
how much was the long lease
it went
for
from
well?
1996 to 2141, by which time the port would probably be underwater.
How
because
much
of
was
raising
the long lease
levels.
Sold for as well then? Because then if you add that to the freehold, that's the total cost of the land to the port, isn't it?
No, not at all. It was sold with the port company coming in, and in 1996. It's absolutely not true. What matters is the fact that we don't own the land. We didn't own the land apart from the residual freehold. We were getting a peppercorn, nothing, no rent. We had no value out of it until 2141. It would probably be underwater by 2141 and therefore probably have a pretty small value. Extracting 10 million and then being able to invest that in regeneration and housing, as will be done, makes absolute financial sense. I'd be terrified if you lot were running the city if you think that that was a bad deal.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that, but there's a lot of criticism of it because
of the
looking at the value which the land has subsequently been sold for being so much more than we got for the whole estate. That, I think, is where people would question
this. That is selling the whole freehold. It's very different. And I know it's difficult. You know, sound bites are easy. Selling the port, flogging the port. It wasn't flogging the port. It was just that small value of the residual freehold, which we probably got 10 or 20 times the third-party value of it.
Does anyone want to have a final say on the port?
Paul? Just a quick thing, just to finish off. I mean, some of my friends down in Avonmouth, it's to do with the port as well, but they are really affected by the poor air quality down there. They're going to be building a tar factory down there and an incinerator to burn London waste.
Okay.
I find it absolutely abhorrent what's going on in Avonmouth, actually, port aside.
You're listening to the BCFM Politics Show, Bristol Mayor Hustings. Another hour to go after the news. Welcome back to our politics show, Mayor Hustings, with eight of the candidates for Bristol Mayor here in the studio. And I'm also joined by one who I'm afraid I only found out this morning was standing because the list was only released by the City Council officially today. That's Tom Baldwin. Do you want to tell us why we should be voting for you, Tom?
Yeah, I'm standing for the Trade Unionist and Socialist Coalition, TUSC, which was formed by Bob Crowe to give a voice back to ordinary people because we've had a raw deal over the last few years. While the rich have been getting richer, we're still paying for their crisis. We've seen falling living standards, cuts and privatisation to our vital services. And TUSC are standing because we want to make Bristol a city that is affordable for all. That means addressing the housing crisis by the building of thousands of council houses owned by us so we can guarantee quality, low rents and secure lifetime tenancies. It means raising wages. We're looking for a £10 minimum wage for council staff and pushing that as far beyond as possible. It means addressing the care and transport issues in the city with public ownership at the heart of the solutions to those. But I think most of all, it means opposing the austerity agenda that's being pushed on us. Anyone who's elected will not be able to carry out their programme without countering the huge cuts being made to Bristol's budget. And yes, that's being pushed by the Tory government, but our local representatives have so far said that there's nothing they can do but to pass them on. We've had £100 million cut in the last 4 years by Ferguson and his cross-party cabinet. That includes things like libraries, care services, city parks. And it can't go on like this. If we allow it to, it'll be nothing less than a complete destruction of those services. But there is an alternative. I would move a budget that is based on what this city needs, not on George Osborne's demands for cuts, and then build a campaign to win back what's been stolen from the city. It can be done. The Tory government were beaten on the latest round of disability cuts, and they can be beaten on this if we take a stand. 5th of May is your chance to do that, to vote against the establishment, to vote for the anti-austerity socialist alternative. And that's why I'm standing for TUSC. Thanks.
Just remind us of your name again.
Yeah, Tom Baldwin. Sorry, standing for TUSC.
Thanks very much.
And Socialist Coalition.
Thanks very much, Tom. Well, as I say, welcome back to the Politics Show, Mayor Hustings. The list of nominees has only just been published today. So that was Tom Baldwin, who's on that list, who wasn't in the studio and hasn't been for most of the debate. But also we've got four more independent candidates standing: Tony Britt, Stony Garnett, Mayor Ku de Hindu, and also John Langley. I'll remind you who is here in a minute, but first we have to pay our tax. At least some of us do. We all need to know that our mayor can work his way around the city balance sheet and income surplus accounts. So I've asked an expert accountant to look at my copy of the City and County of Bristol's accounts from just after the Second World War in 1947. I bought it from the late, great Graham Russell, who some may know, remember, ran a bookstall in his retirement. He used to work at Fry's at St Nicholas Market. Anyway, It makes for interesting reading when compared to today. For example, the city council used to run subsidised cafes to make sure everybody could afford to eat. It used to run the corporation buses also, which made a modest profit for ratepayers. Its equivalent today you have to download from the council website and runs to 111 pages. But our expert accountant pulled out the two or three important pages, the only ones really worth reading. And we're going to see if we can compare the 1947 accounts to those from 2014 and 2015. First thing is to say that all the values from 1947 have been multiplied up by 35 times, which the Bank of England says gives us an equivalent in 2015. So first I'm going to give George a little test to see if he can explain some peculiarities in the more recent figures and ask you all to take a longer look at Bristol City Council's roughly £1 billion annual spending. That's nearly £2,300 for each of the 440,000 men, women and children that live in the city. So, first of all, George, from the more recent figures, the bottom line is a surplus or deficit. The council ran a deficit in 1947, just after the war, equivalent to £10.5 million, and kept its services going. That's now the accountant reports surpluses of £19 million in 2014 and £71 million in 2015. That's a £52 million jump in just 1 year. And anyway, surely with such a surplus, we don't need to be cutting the Bush Respite Care Home for Disabled Families, or in fact anything with that sort of surplus.
Well, first of all, we don't have a £1 billion budget in real terms. Two-thirds of that just goes straight through our bank account and for things like education for schools. So we're left with £345 million. And probably in real terms, after the things that we have absolutely no choice over, we've got a choice of about 10% in terms of how you can adjust that. And even those choices are pretty tough. You know that I've been investing in schemes that have enabled us to save a lot more money. I've been making quite sure that we've got a much more streamlined administration. And we have saved a huge amount of money. We've made money through sensible property deals, which have left us with less running costs and means that we're able to retain most of the money for the key services. But you know, such things as the libraries, which are contentious, we in Bristol have saved our libraries in a way that most other cities have been unable to do, so that we have a higher concentration in terms of libraries, branch libraries per head of population than almost any other city.
The figures, George, we get a £50 million surplus from council housing. Why aren't we able to use this, say, to build 250 more council homes with that?
Well, we are, and that's exactly what we're doing. It's just when you've got huge accounts, you need to manage those accounts wisely, as you do with a large estate. We have spent £100 million in insulating our council estate. Now, that's really important because that's saving people's energy,
so
saving their bills.
So, are we building 250 council homes a year?
No, we're not building 250 council homes a year. We can't under current government restrictions. We keep getting obstacles thrown in our way. When we are building council homes for the first time, new council homes for the first time for over 30 years in Bristol, I'm proud of that. And that is accelerating. Of course, we've only got a few now because we've only had 3 years to do it.
Okay,
But that is increasing and will, subject to government legislation that actually is impeding us, will increase.
You just said that, George. Yeah. Okay.
So just on the council homes, just as a bit of a shout-out, really, there's a demonstration tomorrow in St Paul's, 11:15, Meet of the Malcolm X. Bristol City Council are just about to sell off another load of council houses.
How many,
Paul?
Houses.
Well, it's about 15, but the bigger issue is actually this has been happening, and it's been happening since about 2003, actually. So when you start to say to us, oh, it's only 15 homes, it's still 15 homes.
It will produce 30 homes.
Excuse me, can you not interrupt me, please, George? I'm just trying to get my point
across.
Yeah,
but you keep telling...
No, can you explain that? Okay, George, how can you explain how selling 15 homes means it's possible for us to build?
Well, because these are homes that are not got good access, badly insulated, need restoration, cannot be let economically, but they have a value that will probably raise us about £2.5 million. That full £2.5 million will be reinvested in social housing. The money raised in St Paul's, for instance, I've insisted will be reinvested in social housing in St Paul's. That will be efficient, accessible, lifelong homes that are much more appropriate. There will probably be about 2-for-1 in terms of the reinvestment. So
okay,
it only makes good sense.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, I felt like I was a bit interrupted there, actually. But basically, yeah, I mean, this is a big issue for a lot of people. This is also about gentrification of inner city Bristol. You know, it's a cultural attack on our city as well. So if you've got time to come down tomorrow, 11:15, meet Malcolm X, and Hollis Morgan, they're going to be showing people around these cheap old drums, and we're going to make some noise, and come down if you're available.
Okay, George, the rate support grant from government's down about £20 million just in the last year. At that rate, by the time it comes to vote for the next mayor in another 4 years, there won't be any rate support grant left. I think they call it revenue support grant now, don't they? Why have you let the Treasury keep so much more that they collect from us here in Bristol in central government taxes like capital gains tax, income tax, VAT?
Well, we haven't let the Treasury keep any more than any other city in the UK, and we work together as the 10 core cities in the UK. That's all the cities that aren't all the major cities that aren't London and Edinburgh. I'm the only non-Labour leader, actually, as it happens, and we're absolutely aligned in this, and we work together to try and get as much as possible out of the government. And I think Bristol is doing well.
But am I right in 4 years' time there will be no rate support grant coming at all?
Well, the funding of local government is changing. We will be retaining more of our business rates. The devolution deal will also change the way we fund capital projects. So, yes, there's change, but that is why you need the sort of leadership that I'm giving, and that is making sure that we save money on administration, that we make money where we can make money, so that we help close that gap that is a widening gap over the money that we get from central government.
But it's getting bigger and
bigger,
isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. It makes life really difficult. Look, I came into office to the bad news.
Public health and environment spending in Bristol's down in the last year by £17 million, from £37 million to £24 million. That's nearly halving the budget in 1 year, George.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that you get less public health. I mean, it is it's about how we spend it, and of course there is some damage to some of the services, but Bristol is doing so much better in terms of preserving its services than most other cities.
Okay, would anyone like to come back on the figures?
Yeah, just very quickly, I think this is one of those issues where the mayor just needs to get on his bike or car or train and go to Westminster and start banging on some doors. That's the whole idea of having a mayor, isn't it, really?
Well, that's what I do.
obviously not well enough, George.
It's exactly what I do, and we are doing probably better than almost others. I mean, Manchester were ahead of us because they started this whole process about 10 years ago. I was only able to start it just over 3 years ago.
Now, we're going to hear a clip now from a chap called Carl Mann. He runs something called Homeless Pay It Forward here in Bristol, with the headline in the Post last month, "More rough sleepers than anywhere else in England outside London or in Bristol." Do you think homelessness is shaping the city, shaming the city? And how will you house Bristol's 100 or so, we heard earlier, actually 200 figure of rough sleepers between now and the autumn? But so let's have a listen now to Carl Mann from Homeless Pay It Forward.
I'm Carl Mann. I founded the charity Homeless Pay It Forward.
The previous mayor elections 4 years ago, George Ferguson won. In the run-up to it, there was a lot of talk about housing and homelessness by all the candidates, really promising to deliver social housing to reduce the number of people homeless, and of course it hasn't happened.
Well, they're like magicians, aren't they? Smoke and mirrors, basically. What my analysis of what's going on, they're only going to ever bring it up when election time comes up. They don't really, they try and brush it under the carpet, don't they? Because they don't know what to do. Basically, they haven't got a clue what to do. The government has said that they're going to give £1 million to solve the homeless problem. £1 million won't even sort out the homeless problem in London.
But what would you do? I mean, what can be done?
First of all, is all these empty properties, especially the houses the council still own, instead of selling them off, is revamp them and get them back into the system. Start making some money out of them. Affordable housing. They're building affordable houses, which aren't affordable, and they're not building the council house.
George?
Well, we are building council houses. I absolutely accept that.
Can you give us a figure for the last year? How many council houses in the last year?
We're building about... We built and are building about 35 at the moment. We will have built about 100 by the end of this year, another 100 the next year. It's not anywhere near enough, but it's infinitely more than what was built before under previous administrations over the last 30 years. So we are on an upward trajectory.
Charles Lucas.
In spite of the government trying to trip us up on it.
Charles, this headline, more rough sleepers than anywhere else in England outside of London, is pretty shameful, isn't it?
Absolutely. All of us in this room, from whichever party or position you're sitting around this table, we all absolutely do not want to see people sleeping rough in Bristol. Of course we don't. More needs to be done. We have a massive housing shortage here in Bristol. We need to build more houses in all sectors of the market, whether it be council housing, which I personally favour, over social housing, affordable housing, whatever you want to call it, and private housing, because we desperately need to build a huge number of houses. We also need to provide better facilities for those people in the shorter term who are currently sleeping rough, who need to be accommodated, and in my view a short-term measure for a couple of months over the winter is a step in the right direction, but we need to be providing those beds for those people all year round, and we need to give people a base from which to get a leg up to get their lives back on track.
Marvin, 200 people sleeping on the streets is not nice for them or for anybody, and it's not good for the city. Can you make any promises and commitments if you become mayor as what you'll do about this?
Well, we commit to prioritise it. I mean, the thing that surprises me about it is this did not sneak up on us. You know, we've had a lot of focus on major outward-facing events that's been about fun and been about the city narrative, and that's where I think we've got our priorities wrong. I want the arena, okay? I want world-class sports in Bristol. I want world-class activity coming to the city. But if we made the same kind of political commitment to making sure Bristol's a place in which people could afford to live, in which we sustained our substance misuse services and our mental health services that support some of those vulnerable people in the city, if we had the same kind of political commitment to that as we did to building the city's image to the outside world, which unfortunately is not a narrative and an image that tens of thousands of people in the city are a part of, then we would have made some real progress.
What can you
commit
to, Marvin?
It's only in the last 3 months, to be honest. It's only in the last 3 months that we've started to get this kind of Orwellian rewrite of Bristol's history, in which we have a focus and an interest in inequality and social
inclusion. What will you commit to, Marvin?
Well, I'm committing to making sure it's top of our priority. I'm committing to making sure that we invest in our network of voluntary community sector organisations that support some of those marginalised people in the city, and committing to building homes and making sure that we protect people across the private rental sector.
Okay.
The crisis in homes and homelessness is not a surprise. It's been coming up for us
for years. Tony Dyer for the Green Party.
Okay, well, you presented us with a budget for 1947, and now we're talking about housing. So let's talk about what happened for the 30 years after that budget was produced. And what happened was, across the country, we were building council homes in this country at a rate of 150,000 a year. After 1979, when Margaret Thatcher was elected, in the 30 years following that dropped down to only 20,000 a year. The policies that were introduced by the Conservative government under Margaret Thatcher, and then unfortunately kept in place by the Labour government that followed it, were increasingly restrictive on councils. They placed severe restrictions on the housing revenue account, stopped it from borrowing money from outside the housing revenue account, which meant that it was almost impossible to deliver council housing. What I'm proposing because we need solutions. We can look back at the past, but we need to look at what we need to do for the future. And what I'm proposing is to set up a separate housing company, which is outside of the housing revenue account, and that company will deliver new housing at target social rents. We're looking at building 2,000 social rent homes over the next 4 years, and we can do that by taking the pressure away from the housing revenue account, and then by taking the pressure away from the housing revenue account, that will reduce our need to have to sell off social housing to subsidise new housing.
Okay, Kay Barnard.
Yeah, well, I think Marvin was right. It is about priorities and how the decisions are made on what the council should focus on. And obviously homelessness is a real blight on the city. I mean, it's shocking in a country as wealthy as Britain when a country like Jordan has managed to put up with at least 1 million refugees. We can't find space for a couple of hundred people in Bristol. But I don't think that the control over the budget should be in one pair of hands. One person shouldn't be able to say this. I know the full council has to agree the budget, but after that, the mayor has the right to change things. And who's choosing those priorities? And we need to see the books. I mean, you can't make decisions just on the simple figures in front of us here. we need detailed assessment of where the money's going and how it's being spent.
Okay. Paul Turner for UKIP.
Well, Mara's absolutely right. This is not something that's suddenly appeared up. I would love to better blame this on George, but it's not all his fault, because we've had homeless people in this city, sadly, for many, many decades.
I think it's fair to say it's increased over the last 2 years, George, quite a lot, actually.
It has, I'd agree with that.
Everywhere, just
but
about.
As Mayor, one thing that I would do is the 200 people that are sleeping rough on the streets at the moment, we can house them, albeit potentially temporarily, very, very quickly, very, very cost-effectively, in prefabricated buildings that will give them security, safety, warm, dry accommodation, whilst... And we must admit that we must understand that just giving them a home is not the answer to all the problems. That is just a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And we must make sure that once we take that step, we take the next step and the next step to make sure that these people are housed properly at the end of the day.
Not putting people in crates like they're they're proposing to do in Newport, over in Newport. Anyway, Paul.
Well, the reality of the situation out there is, we've seen a massive increase in spice use as well, which is that funny drug. It's sprayed with over 700 chemicals, most of them untested, and I think we've had about 15 deaths recently in Bristol. That's affecting the homeless population a lot. So what I'm trying to say is that all of these issues, they're all connected, and actually, as a city, it costs us more. It costs us more because it increases crime. It's all connected. And what my solution really is what Carl said on that little excerpt that you put on, was get those empty buildings open. There's no reason. 21 days before Christmas, the council promised us that they would open empty buildings. We're in April now. It's gone. I can't believe time's gone so quickly. They haven't opened the buildings. They put a few more beds on Jamaica Street in the hostel. But apart from that, we haven't seen anything. People are dying on our streets, and it's time that Bristol City Council and the service directors and the incumbent mayor and the future one, whoever he or she is, took a stand on it. And it is what Kay just said. It's about political will. If the political will is there to do something about it, it will be done.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what's been said. What I want to add, though, actually, because I was particularly insulted, and there was an article quite recently where the lead officer for housing in our local authority described the people living in tents as camping. And for me, it's really dangerous when officers are using such language in the media, because it's about othering and it's about separation. The other side of this is about how we prevent people, because street homelessness is the absolute tip of the iceberg, because we've got sofa surfing, we've got 500 children woke up this morning in temporary bed and breakfast accommodation. It's unsuitable. We've got a crisis in housing. It's huge. It's not just about the 200 people on the streets.
We're going to have a clip now from you talking there about the sort of wider problem. A lot of people hungry just simply don't have enough money to feed themselves, and one of the places that they go to on Stapleton Road is the Wild Goose Cafe. And I spoke just at the end of last week to Johnny Angel, who runs the Wild Goose Cafe, which doesn't get contributions from government deliberately. It said it doesn't want to do that. Really about how the situation for the people at the very bottom of the pile, income wise, people that can hardly afford to feed themselves, how things have been going for them.
Mind if we sit down there? Is that okay?
My name is Johnny Angel, and I am the project leader of the Wild Goose Stropping Centre, a project within Crisis Centre Ministries, and we provide between 500 and 600 meals a day. So we'll provide breakfast, lunch, and evening meal. Evening meals are from Sunday through to Friday, and during the daytime is Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We provide food. We ask for a donation, but if people can't provide a donation, we don't refuse them a meal. And then when they ask for help, we will engage with them in whatever means that they need, whether it's offering a phone call, access to the internet, helping with a form, or actually trying to walk alongside them to engage with other services. So we're very much about feeding people and engaging them with signposting to whatever service is best suited to them. We are a Christian charity, and so most of our funding is from people who give, churches that give, and also some trusts. We won't take any government funding because it normally comes with targets, and for what we do, we can't set any targets. So therefore, it is very much a faith ministry. Our food is provided mainly from Fair Share, so we have a daily delivery, which is either on its use-by date or close to its best-before date. And when the food comes in, we then decide what we're going to cook during the day. We also get donations from schools and churches and individuals. So I sort of describe working in the kitchen as ready, steady, cook on an extremely large scale, because we don't have a menu, because we don't necessarily know what we're going to cook each day. We have 450 to 500 volunteers, we have two full-time and one part-time staff, including myself, running the Goose. So if we didn't have volunteers, which are Christians from other churches, we wouldn't be able to actually provide the service that we do. 5 years ago, we were feeding, 70, 80 people. We most probably feed between 300 and 400 people now. So the number of meals that we provide is higher because people normally have seconds or thirds if they can. We have noticed an increase in people coming in. Not a huge increase because it's been like this for the last few years, 2-3 years. But we've seen a cross range and a greater diversity of people coming and using our services. So where a lot of people felt that we were just here for those in addiction, now the service users come from a much more diverse range across society.
Well, obviously a growing number of people, not just rough sleepers, obviously, but a lot of more people who just simply cannot afford to feed themselves in the city. I'm just going to go around everybody now, one by one, and ask what we can do to reverse this trend, starting with you, Christine Townsend.
For me, it's about making sure that there are support services in and around the people that are using the Wild Goose Cafe that will enable them to find safe spaces and trust workers, whether those are paid or volunteer workers, so they are able to open up and allow services to support them so that they aren't in the position where that's how they're needing to feed themselves.
Yeah, the Wild Goose Space is an amazing, amazing service, really, isn't it? And considering it takes no government funds as well, it's even more fantastic. Again, the reality of the situation is that on Stapleton Road, as many people will or may not know, is there's often a queue all the way down the road, and it is very something kind of like it's very 1930s about it, the workhouse poor. And I think that's what George Osborne and his Tory government want to do, is take us back to a Victorian era. So I think more support should be going to the Wild Goose Space, really.
Well, I think it just proves that the austerity measures imposed by the government are just not working. To think that some of these people are obviously sort of homeless and addictions, but a lot of the people there are just people who just cannot afford to feed themselves and are obviously struggling in other ways as well, just to keep their head above water. And this is where, again, I think that the mayor's role comes in several ways. Firstly, to start challenging the government on the austerity measures, and secondly, to make sure that people are supported properly in the community. And we hinted on it earlier, and I said it at the beginning of the programme, this is again down to spending prioritisation, and it just shows that the priorities of our current authority are just completely ski-whiffed.
Yeah, well, we seem to be going back to Victorian times, don't we? Not just the 1930s. And people are struggling to survive on the minimum wage, sometimes working two or three jobs just to keep their family afloat. So, yeah, absolutely, we need support services. And the food that gets wasted by the supermarkets, I think that's really great that it's reused and not just thrown and sent off to landfill. Something that's positive out of what should not be happening anyway.
Tony?
Well, I'm going to go back to the 1947 budget again because you brought it in. If we look back at 1945, we had a Labour government elected that was facing an economic crisis that was even worse than what we're facing today, because it was an entire continent had been devastated by war. And what they did, they invested in the country. They basically put in a programme of public works to do work. They created full employment, giving people jobs that were paying a decent wage. It didn't work overnight. I have members of my family that were buried in a pauper's grave in 1959. So we still did have huge amounts of poverty even after that. But that's what we need to do now as well. And we can do some of that locally. We can insist that we have a living wage paid within the council, and that's the real living wage, not the fake one. That we insist on the council's suppliers also have a living wage, and also that we invest in those areas of the economy that create decent jobs. At the moment, one of the most thriving parts of the economy, as long as the government stays out of its way, is the green economy, and we can create jobs that way.
Marvin Rees.
Yeah, I think this actually tests us as a city in that it's not... we have to have a kind of a change of mindset. This is not just about Bristol City Council. I think that the Wild Goose is a fantastic example, actually, of stuff being done outside of the City Council's resources. So we have a thriving community voluntary sector, somewhat, even though some of them have, like Hawkspring recently, came to the edge of existence, saved the game by a private funder. But also we have two big universities, we have a health service, we have a police service. If we want to have real social impact in Bristol, we have to look at how we mobilise priorities and resources and strategies across all those cities' institutions. Otherwise, it's just the 350 that the council spend, 350 council spend every year. I think, too, there is a broader piece. There's a fantastic proverb says, don't strain gnats and swallow camels. You know, while we take action on a local level, there is a piece of work to be done on city leadership, which is about challenging political priorities in general. And it has to be that it is not just about having the economy grow. In some sense, in many ways, we've reached the end of what economic growth alone can do for us as a policy tool. It has to be about tackling inequality and inclusion. If we don't do that, not only will we undermine the future of our economic prosperity, but actually we'll be in political crisis because there will be no political stability. And we saw evidence of that, I think, in 2011. Such loose ties to our common story that people were willing to go on the street and riot at the smallest instigation.
Okay.
So inequality is essential.
Okay, Charles Lucas, this general situation of people, some of them working people, simply not able to feed themselves.
Well, this is a personal priority of mine, and certainly something that I will attempt to tackle if I'm elected in May. The Wild Goose Cafe is a fantastic organisation. I have been and seen it. I'm actually a volunteer with the Bristol Soup Run Trust on a regular basis, and we go out and we do in sort of working in cohesion with Wild Goose and other organisations such as St Mungo's, we do go out and help those who are sleeping rough, who are hungry. And that is something that shouldn't be necessary in Bristol in 2016. I'm sure we all agree that. We need to address this issue as an absolute top priority.
Okay, Charles, how?
Sorry.
Address it how?
How? Well, we need to increase our, in my view, we need to increase funding to address both issues, homelessness and hunger.
Okay, George.
I think we have to deal with the fundamentals. I hate the fact that charity is having to pick up society's problems, but that is the current situation. I talked about greater redistribution of wealth within the city if we had a local income tax rather than a council tax. I think we are a kind city in general. We were nominated as the kindest city in the UK. I mean, that's, to me, is the best thing we could possibly have. So there are individuals. I was talking to Fair Share the other day who are doing great work. They're now distributing tons of food every day, and that is absolutely brilliant. But the fundamental is that we get everybody into full decent employment. We are doing well in that, but it's still leaving a lot of people behind, and I want to close that gap. We've still got nearly 6% unemployment amongst men and 3% amongst women. It's lower amongst women almost than any other city. That I don't know, that may be down to some special reasons, but we've got to keep on looking to achieve full employment.
Okay,
across
some
the city.
Some say the mayor has turned Bristol into a dictatorship, not George personally, but just having a mayor, and diminished the power of councillors to represent us. So maybe people are thinking, well, what's the point in voting for a councillor if actually it's only the mayor that has the power? Now there's talk of a metro mayor for the Bristol City region. Do you support this idea, and where will you be standing, George?
Yes and no. Yes, I do support it as part of the deal, because you've got to have some sort of governance for the combined authority services that will come out of this. And no, I won't be standing okay. for it, because I'm only dedicated to making quite sure I finish this job okay. and that Bristol ends up better for it.
Just let's go back 4 years and see what your answer to that question was 4 years ago when you were on our mayor hustings that we held. I think George, you're the only person who is in this room now who was in the same room 4 years ago or three and a half years ago.
That's true.
I wish I was standing to be mayor of the metropolitan area so that we could get our heads around all those big transport and homes and other issues that we share with our neighbours. I think we've got to have very creative partnerships between us and the neighbours that have failed to really gel so far. So not only do we need an integrated transport authority, I think we need an integrated planning authority that looks at how we plan for homes for the future. And we're going to need a lot more, and we're going to need a lot more actually that are even being promised by the absent candidate. And I think to do that, we're going to have to look at the rental levels that enable the housing associations to build, because new regulations have come in, or new guidance has come in from the government via the HCA, the Housing Communities Agency, that means that unless one adjusts those rental levels, then the housing associations are not going to be able to produce the housing. So there's a big discussion to be had there across a lot of different private and public partners.
Well, I suppose it's not fair, really. George, you've got a double go there from 4 years ago as well. But let's go around everybody else to see what you make of this whole idea of a metro mayor, starting with you, Kay Barnard, from the Lib Dems. What would it mean for the city, and are you in favour of a metro mayor?
No, I'm not in favour of a metro mayor. It's yet another layer of government, and I think that's a silly idea. What we need is the four councils in the area to work together sensibly to solve the problems over housing and transport. Absolutely. And I pledge to, if I can, to push for another referendum. I mean, it was the Lib Dems who managed to get it reinstated in legislation that Bristol could have another referendum. We were barred from it previously. And I think the recent vote in Bath, there was a massive vote against having a mayor, showed they've been looking over their shoulders at what's been going on in Bristol. And I think they decided they didn't like what they saw.
Tony?
Well, Greens in general, and myself in particular, are in favour of devolution. I think it's always better to try and have decision-making made as close as possible to the people that are most affected by it. But for that to happen, you need to have a governance structure that allows transparency and scrutiny by members of the public and also their elected representatives. My concern is that the model we've got at the moment doesn't provide that, and with this Metro Mail, it's a Metro Mail which is going to have a cabinet, I understand, of possibly five people, which would be the leaders of each of the local authorities involved, plus the Metro Mail himself. So I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done about the democracy and transparency. And also, I think the other problem all of us are facing is that this deal has been done to a certain extent under a cloud of secrecy, and so little is known about it, and I think we need to have more open discussions about what has actually been agreed.
Marvin Rees, do you support the idea of a Metro Mayor? Will you be supporting this?
I'm really concerned about the imposition of another political structure on the area. I think the question should have been, can you display the behaviours we want, which is much more joined up working across local authority boundaries? So, I mean, we're locked into it. I'm going to say we'll go with the Metro Mayor because it is a gateway to getting those devolution of powers and resources that we actually need. But with a very heavy caveat that we must be able to negotiate to make sure that what we're not getting is more concentrations of power. But you asked two questions, Tony, because you also asked about concentrations of power in Bristol and the position of elected members, and I think that is a very, very important issue. In the briefings we had before the last mayoral election, we were told one of the first decisions we'd have to make if we won was how much of our executive power would we share with the cabinet. And I think the fact that no power has been shared with the cabinet, and that the position of the people that we elect into Bristol City Council have been undermined because they have no power, has been absolutely disastrous for Bristol's economy. And when you don't listen to people, when you keep all power, then you make bad decisions and you end up running over the hill and taking no one with you. And we haven't had leadership in Bristol, we've had rulership. And that's a major challenge for Bristol.
Charles Lucas.
Tony, I sit before you as a councillor on Bristol City Council. Basically, in my opinion, councillors, certainly since I've been elected, are impotent. We have absolutely no role to play in decision-making in Bristol beyond the budget, and even that can be overruled. So one of the key policies of my campaign is that I have pledged to introduce a council veto, where if whoever the mayor is heading off down a road with some policy that the majority of councillors, i.e. of the 70 democratically elected representatives of the people of Bristol, if 75% of those councillors want to stop the mayor heading off on a path that they do not agree with, they can block that policy. I'm already committed to that. Just to answer the second part of your question, I am in favour of a Metro Mayor, and I'm in favour of a Metro Mayor because Bristol and the West of England need the devolution deal. It is a condition of the deal that's being offered by central government, and we want devolution. I'm entirely pro the devolution bill and the investment it will bring to Bristol.
But it's almost as if, sorry to challenge you, but you know, it's almost like you're saying, well, yes, I agree, the mayor is a dictator and it doesn't really work, but I want an Uber Gripen dictator over the top of the mayor.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is I wholeheartedly support the mayoral system in Bristol. I think it is better. If you look at the 20 to 30 years, most recent years before the mayoral system was introduced, we had a succession of Labour and Liberal Democrat administrations that actually did get nothing done. We all agree that.
But how
Bristol
does that
stagnated. Hang on, let me finish, sure, Tony. Bristol stagnated. So the mayoral system is better because one individual has the power to make difficult decisions. It doesn't get bogged down in party
But
politics.
How does that sit with the impotence of councillors now?
Well, that's why I'm saying the councillors must have the opportunity to influence the mayoral decision.
Paul.
Well, I think from a local mayor point of view, it does raise the question of how democratic is the city. Going back a slight step, I would like to say I agree an awful lot with what Tony was saying from a working with our neighbouring authorities point of view. It is essential if we're going to have some degree of transportation system that's actually going to work not only for Bristol but for the South West. So I do agree a lot with what Tony is saying about devolution of powers and working with our neighbours, but that does not necessarily mean that we need a metro mayor running it as we've got a mayor trying to run Bristol at the moment. From a local point of view, having one person in place that can, for all intents and purposes, ignore the other 70 people that have been elected does draw very, very serious questions over our democratic system that we're operating in Bristol and whether it's actually working or not. No one man or woman has all the answers and knows everything. And the whole idea of having a mayor is, as far as I'm concerned, is to be looking at what the councillors and the councillors are doing, bringing people together, and if need be, being that deciding vote, not necessarily making all the decisions on their own individually.
Okay, Paul Savile, what's your take on this metro mayor?
Yes, I'm not in support of it at all. I think, the big thing really is even as we're talking about it now, it seems like it's going to be forced upon Bristol and Bristolians anyway. Surely it should be up to Bristolians to decide, not for council bosses and council workers to decide for us. That's up to everyday Bristolians to decide. That's direct democracy. I'm really in favour of direct democracy, bringing things back to a grassroots level so communities can decide what's best for them, rather than having this, this real top-down hierarchy. Go the whole hog, dictatorship, which we've seen over the past 3.5 years. And I think a lot of Bristolians would agree with me that it's just another layer of government, really.
I suppose if it's a dictatorship at the moment, there's about to be a coup next month when everyone votes. Anyway, Christine, I mean, there is a wider issue here that if we widen the electorate who's going to vote on a metro mayor, the chances are, if you look at the equivalent councils around, it might be Conservative, whereas Labour tends to not vote for Conservatives to put them in charge of everything. Anyway, what are your thoughts about this metro mayor?
Well, actually, it's largely along those lines. I mean, the area that the metro mayor would cover are hugely different. We've got very rural areas just outside Bristol, very different demographics, and then we've got a hugely multicultural city with particular concentrations in particular parts of our city. And I would struggle to envisage one elected person that would be able to truly represent and understand all of those areas. Now, I know that one of these arguments is, we have Avon and Somerset Police, but the structures within the police are broken down so that actually the police that force that are operating in Bristol are very, very different to those that are operating in and around Somerset, and the priorities are able to be different. Governance and scrutiny, those are the two areas that I'm interested in kind of seeing around this with the metro mayor. And it's another layer of gatekeepers, quite honestly, that just makes somebody that's supposed to be democratically elected further away from those that they're actually representing.
George is using his opportunity to come in here.
Yeah. I'd just like to stress there's a very different sort of mayor to the city mayor. And basically, the mayor becomes the chair of a cabinet, and the cabinet is made up of the four leaders of the four authorities. And there are very few decisions that would be mayor-only decisions. So it is a cooperative in terms of the governance of the four authorities. And I don't think this is really all about the metro mayor. I know that's where the media has been looking, but this is about a £1 billion deal for the Greater Bristol region. And
Over quite a long period, George.
Yes, but we can borrow up front against it in order to invest, in order to make money, in order to make jobs, in order to build skills.
It sounds like bribery.
You might put it that way, Tony, in terms of the politics, and I wouldn't absolutely deny it, but it's a deal that would be damn stupid for us to turn down.
Okay, Tony Dyer.
Yeah, I was interested at the beginning of that, George. You said that this would be a much better system because there would be a cabinet and they were all have we'll all have decision-making powers, what you seem to imply. So why aren't we having that already in Worcester.
Well, we do in effect. You know that I've got a rainbow cabinet, and it's a similar structure. It's the mayor and four assistant mayors for people, place, neighbourhoods, and business change.
So let me just ask you a straight question. A very straight question, very simple one. You answer very easily.
Yeah.
Will the Metro Mayor, will the other four local authority leaders be able to outvote the Metro Mayor?
Yes, in most conditions.
Does that happen in your cabinet at the moment?
They've never have I made a decision against the majority of the cabinet.
Can they outvote you in your cabinet at the moment?
No, and I think that's right. Otherwise, it would simply go back to the old dithering party politics that used to hold Bristol back before we had a mayoral system.
OK, George, we're going to go on now, and we'll start with Christine Townsend, because the government has just announced that it will be forcing all our schools to become academies. Is this good for the next generation of young Bristolians?
The idea that central government would force any local authority school to become an academy, I find absurd. There isn't evidence that the academy structure is necessarily better than the local authority. In fact, it's the opposite. The recent Education Select Committee report actually said there is no evidence that academies are better than local authority schools. No.
Paul Saville.
Again, it's down to privatisation, isn't it? They want to get into every kind of area of public service and just privatise everything for monetary gain. So, yeah, it's terrible, isn't it?
OK, Paul Turner?
Well, I'm no expert on education, so on subjects like this, I would bow down to Christine's much superior knowledge and expertise in it, which I think is really where a mayor should come in, really, to look for the people who actually know and are experts in fields and actually use them as advisors to make decisions.
OK, for the Lib Dems, Kay Barnard.
No, absolutely not a sensible policy at all. I mean, even worse, they're going to get rid of the parent governors. So the parents of the kids at the school will actually have no say at all in the way the school is run. I think that's pretty bad.
This government seems to be trying to produce a row series of policies which are going to go into the list of the worst ever policies introduced by any government ever existed. It's a really awful idea. It takes away the whole idea of academies in the first place. We're supposed to be allowing parents to have a greater say. Now they're doing the opposite. They're taking away any involvement of parents in governing the schools. It's an awful idea.
Marvin?
It's very bad policy, and it seems to be driven more by ideology and a commitment to rolling back any influence and undermining the ability of local government to operate rather than it is based on evidence. And I'm particularly concerned about the undermining of local accountability and obviously, as Kay just mentioned as well, I mean, taking parents out. Schools have to be connected to local communities. They have to be connected to parents. And if they're not, we lose the opportunity to influence, which is one of the flagship policy areas, the flagship interventions that we have to be able to hold to account and to shape if we're going to have any hope of kind of delivering the kind of society we want.
Charles Lucas, this is the next generation. Quite a lot of concern about this policy.
Well, of course there's concern. I imagine I'm going to be isolated on this particular one because I personally think it's a very sound policy. I think there is tremendous potential for this. And if you look at education, I can only speak with any fraction of knowledge and nothing like the knowledge that Christine has, but I can speak with a fraction of knowledge of the Bristol education, that since academies were first introduced, the quality of education in Bristol and the results that are being achieved have improved. There is no denying that. And the organisations that have come in and are delivering a better education to our children, I have to say that I personally believe it to be a good step, because ultimately all of us want is the best education possible for all the young people in Bristol and across the country. The one thing I would say that I don't agree with the policy of academisation is that I do believe that parents should be involved. I think there is a role for parents in all schools.
Okay, before we go to George, quickly, Marvin and Christine want you to come in. Marvin first.
I was just interested to hear from Charles what he thought that potential was. He said a tremendous potential in academisation, enforced academisation.
The potential is that the education that will be provided to the young people of Bristol and right across the country will be better than was delivered under recent administrations here in Bristol. There has been a marked improvement in recent years.
Do you sympathise, do you have any space at all for those people that are pointing out the warning signs of lost local accountability, increased selection in schools?
That'll do, yeah. Charles, just quickly, before you reply to that.
all these issues need to be addressed. Of course they do. And we haven't seen the fine print of the bill or the deal that's being proposed. But of course, where there are concerns, they need to be addressed.
Christine?
Marvin.
In the previous hour, Charles, you identified the Merchants Academy being sponsored by the Merchant Ventures as a really good example of a school that's been turned around 4 years ago. You could have said the same actually about City Academy, which was also a Merchant Venture involved school, still is a Merchant Venture on the chair of the body. It's since been done for institutional racism. It's now in special measures and it's in its second year. The Merchants Academy in November 2015 was investigated by the adjudicator and was found to have unlawful admissions arrangements.
City Academy, yes.
John Laycock is a Merchant Venture, and if you want to see the evidence that the City Academy, the Merchants Academy, the Bristol Cathedral and Colston Girls School are Merchant Venture involved schools, then I can show you that evidence.
Anyway,
but that is what the Merchant Venture sponsors,
George,
in this city has done to our state education system.
George Ferguson, should we be forcing schools to all become academies?
No. I think it's a very dogmatic approach. It's an example of centralised governance. I think it should be local choice and school choice. Now, I come dogma-free in this case. What I mind about is results, and that's why I'm very interested in what Christine has to say. I think Christine's got a lot of knowledge in this particular area, and I will always take a judgment by what will produce the best results.
Okay, now we've only got a couple of minutes, but a really quick fire round, final round of questions. The EU referendum, should Britain stay in or get out, and why? Let's start with UK Barnard.
Well, I think I approach this from the point of view of Bristol. Bristol's a hugely international city, and a lot of the companies have partners or work with other companies in Europe. So as far as Bristol concerned, absolutely we should stay in.
Tony.
You want a very quick answer? I'll give you a very quick answer. We should stay in.
Marvin?
Stay in. And I think it's worth pointing out, I think many of the out arguments boil down to, well, 50 years ago we were a global power, but it's not 50 years ago. We're now an interdependent world. And I think it's old school to be saying we should be leaving.
Charles Lucas?
In which case I'm old school because I'm out.
George Ferguson?
George. Well, I think it'd be economic and social madness, actually. I mean, I know that we put more in as a country, but I tell you, as a city, we benefit hugely. And that's where I look at it from. Bristol has benefited enormously, both directly and also indirectly. Our universities have benefited enormously through...
Okay, George.
Okay.
Christine.
In.
Stay in.
I'm still making my mind up. Still don't know. But I do think it's another case of divide and rule.
And I guess we'll finish with somebody who I think we know the answer from the UK Independence Party.
You're making assumptions there, but yes, I'm for out. And the main reasons are the complete lack of democracy in the European Union and also the extraordinarily high level of corruption. Yes, George is right, we do get funding here from Europe, but that is only taxes that we already create here and send to Europe in the first place. We get roughly less than 50% back into this country of the funding we send to the European Union in the first place. So I'm definitely out.
I'll just make a final comment. I look at the state of the country since we joined in 1975 and make my mind up based on that. But anyway, we've been you've been hearing from Bristol First, George Ferguson, from the Conservatives, Charles Lucas, from Labour, Marvin Rees, from the Lib Dems, Kay Barnard, Green Party, Tony Dyer, from UKIP, Paul Turner, Independence for Bristol, Christine Townsend, and also Independent, Paul Saville. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next is the Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. You can listen again to the show online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm away next week at the delegate meeting of the National Union of Journalists, but we'll be back with the politics show, God willing, in a fortnight. And in 3 weeks, on the 29th of April, we'll do what we just did all again with the police and crime.